Accession number 16395, Reel 7.
General Crookenden, Reel 7.
I never understand why the Chinese communists in Malaya sometimes attacked planters, or had done in the previous 3 or 4 years, but to my knowledge never attacked most of us in the towns and in the army and civilian headquarters in our own homes. My wife and family and myself, we drove freely anywhere in the country without escort, in a civilian car. Weekends we used to go swimming on the beaches of Port Dickson. We never had any sense of any great personal danger. Now against that, of course, before General Templar arrived as High Commissioner, Sir Henry Gurney had been ambushed and murdered on the road up the Cameron Highlands. But we often went to the Cameron Highlands or Fraser's Hill, the hill stations in Malaya, in our civilian car with the family. No real sense of danger. Templar himself was a complete square peg in a square hole. He was a benevolent dictator. And what some people forget is that 9/10 of his effort, daily effort, was put into building a new Malaya, and only 1/10, perhaps a fifth, of his effort, intelligence, character and time, was spent in fighting the Chinese communists. He had a flair which was greatly admired and respected by Malays and Chinese alike, quite apart from the British serving under him. An example was a village called Tanjong Malim. Very soon after Templar arrived, the communist terrorists came out of the jungle into this new village in Pira, one of the northern states. The young Chinese resettlement officer, a very brave gang of young men, helping to resettle these villages, was shot dead. Outside the coffee shop, 11 o'clock in the morning, poor view of everybody. Templar immediately took a helicopter, flew up with his police escort and army and so on, into the village, assembled the villagers, who refused to give any information at all, and announced that he was the new High Commissioner. He was setting up all over the village post boxes. Every villager would be handed a form to fill in, and they would all write down on that form exactly what they'd seen and heard. Any detail, however small, was important as to what had happened the day before by this murder of a Chinese resettlement officer. And he said, we shall collect all these reports tomorrow, and nothing will be done. You needn't sign them, but I want everybody to write a full account. And as you can imagine, they collected, emptied each of these pillar boxes, all with blank sheets of paper. So he took another helicopter, went up there, and said, you have refused to obey me. You have given no help to the security services. And so I'm arranging you all, men, women and children, will now be sent back to communist China. Your village will be razed to the ground and the land itself sown with salt. Everybody laughed. So, he can't do that. Mummy, he can't do. But for the astonishment of all his officials and people like me, exactly what happened. And I've never discovered how he'd arranged that or how his staff had arranged that with the Chinese. Because they were all taken back to China. And the village was erased from the ground. And this went through Malaya, as you can imagine, like a dose of salt. I mean, Templar never spoke a game without everybody paying attention. Yet against that, he and his wife Peggy did immense work in building up health, education, grooming them for voting, which they never had before. And in particular, he championed the cause of the planters, the labour force in the British, mostly British, and Malay and Chinese plantations. A large number of the labour force were Tamils from South India. And even in the best-run British plantations, their labour lines where they lived were disgracefully primitive. No proper running water, no proper latrines. Really extremely poor management. And so every labour force, although the Tamil is not a natural guerrilla, they never provided people to fight the Chinese communists. They provided a lot of information and a lot of sympathy for the Chinese communists. So he transformed the attitude even of the British planters to their own labour. One must admit a number of British planters, very vocal in their local association, UPAM, the United Planters Association of Malaya, were pretty obstructive in against any attempt to modernize their own labor lines.
Can you say anything about the performance of the British units, British Army units that were sent to the emergency?
I was to an extent intimately connected with army operations, although I wasn't on the general staff, I was on the High Commissioner's staff. We had to discuss with practically every battalion during its tour its mode of operation in the jungle, its relations with the police and the civil service, its contribution it could make to defense of the Chinese new villages, the imposition of food control, as well as the tactical operations in the jungle. So I knew nearly all the COs, and it was fascinating how each battalion reacted differently to the environment and to the task in the jungle. Common to them all was the striking success of the national servicemen, who all, or practically all, thoroughly enjoyed their time in Malaya, I think because they felt they were doing something useful and not hanging about in England, blanking stones on the road into the barracks. But the battalions varied very much with the way they treated the local people. I'll give an example. We had in North Selangor, don't forget, Kuala Lumpur and my bulletin, Director of Operations, all that stuff in Kuala Lumpur were in Selangor. North of Kuala Lumpur, North Selangor, was the Royal West Kents, a very fine battalion, very well disciplined, highly efficient, very good CO, and they hardly ever killed the communists. Their success rate, I'm exaggerating slightly perhaps, the success rate in the jungle was low. In South Selangor was the 1st Battalion, the Suffolk Regiment, and they were equally good battalion, not quite so smart perhaps, not quite so good at bullshit, but well-disciplined and cheerful lot of people. But they killed more communists than anybody else. And we struggled to think what the reason was. You couldn't possibly say that the West Kents were a bad battalion. They were a jolly fine battalion. You couldn't say they were any better or worse than the Suffolks. But the main difference, I came to the conclusion, having been around both at great length, the Suffolk CO, I think was a part Australian, had made an absolute set at the local police. The police had not done terribly well. Their reputation confidence was not very high when I arrived and when Templar arrived. Templar built them up like mad. But the Suffolks went out of their way to help the police, in a particular special branch, in all over South Selangor. I mean, they gave the special branch officer extra staff, clerks, an officer if he wanted one, as an assistant intelligence officer. They were most hospitable to them. They were always South Sri Lanka policemen, all British, of course, were always in and out of the Suffolk officers and sergeants' messes. They backed up the police, and they took their advice about patrolling in the jungle and everything else, and they established most cordial relationships with the local police. So the slightest sniff of information, the special branch in the in Milan police in South Sri Lanka would be right there, and their own, the Suffolk's own intelligence officer in the special branch head office would be right onto the information. And I don't think the relations in North Sri Lanka with the West Kents were quite so good. Same everywhere. Johor was the second Gurkha Rifles, commanded by Colonel General Rickard. He was the same. He had excellent relations with the police. Not only official relations, they went out of the way to establish warm friendliness. I mean, things you wouldn't think would matter. Having to the mess, having them to your private quarter, drinks, as well as material support. And the other feature of Malaya, I suppose every form of armed conflict, practically every battalion on arriving, in England, from England, had a what they now call blue on blue. Is that uncanny? Practically everyone. If it wasn't blue on blue, it was our people shooting innocent civilians. The Scots Guards had it. The Suffolks had one. Every single battalion, in the first month or two, or maybe a slightly longer, would have one of their patrols firing on another of their own. Of course, it's difficult in the jungle to avoid it. That was another feature. But I flew back when the time came from Malaya with a Britannia, no, it wasn't a Britannia, a Hastings load of National Servicemen, time expired, RAF and Army, going back to England. And of course, in that long 5-day trip in those days, or six, you got to know them all very well. And practically every soldier, National Serviceman, time expired, agreed with me. If he'd done it gladly an extra year, if he'd been allowed to stay in Milan. And of course, in 2 years, you don't get to know the jungle. We could have done better if we'd left them 3 years, but it wasn't possible under the terms of national service. Just like the American disasters in Vietnam, partly due, in my view, to the astonishing rule that nobody, any rank, general to private, could stay in Vietnam more than 1 year. A great friend of mine took the 1st Cavalry Division with 450 helicopters to Vietnam. And he, years later, he told me all about it. He nearly wept when he described how, with a 1 year rule, you come down to platoon and company level. It means that every platoon of 20 or 30 men is changing every week, either going back to the States, or leave, or sickness, or recreation, or they call it R&R. You never got your fire teams, your fighting units together. And they certainly didn't know the jungle like some of our people did in Malaya.